The Bizarre Cast contains adult themes and explicit content. Listener discretion is advised.
Greetings, ghouls and girls and everything in between, monsters. It is a special, well, it's not very special, but it is a Halloween episode for sure of the Bizarre Cast with returning honorary vendor of the bazaar. It is David Weiner. David, welcome back.
Happy to pull my cart into the marketplace for this episode.
So there's cobwebs everywhere because I haven't been here in about a month. It's not decorations. I am back in the fray. And today we want to rekindle some glowing memories of Halloween time and share a few stories from the vaults and the mists of time. So let's start off today, David. Firstly, if people are new to the show, would you like to tell them who you are and why we're chatting today?
Yeah, who am I? I ask that question to myself every morning when I look in the mirror. Who am I and who do I want to be to other people? I am a documentary filmmaker these days. I make super documentaries about genre entertainment, so focusing on the 80s, and directed a movie called In Search of Darkness, a 4.5-hour movie about 80s horror films. Just finished In Search of Darkness Part 2, and I'm working on In Search of Tomorrow, which is about 80s sci-fi movies. And prior to that, entertainment journalist, where I was the editor-in-chief of Famous Monsters of Filmland magazine, and written for lots of folks and Entertainment Tonight. And then I was born in New York. I had a wonderful childhood in that New York area, and it'll all tie into Halloween Tales.
Exactly, guys. So he's a worthy guest for your ears today.
arguably.
Well, you've come back multiple occasions for more of my torture on you. So, David, we'll start with yourself then, because there's going to be more on In Search of Darkness 2. We don't want to spoil the surprise. That will be coming towards the end of the show. Mm-hmm. But what, firstly, are some of your favorite Halloween memories growing up? Why is it such a special time of year for you?
Halloween, I live and breathe Halloween to this day. It has always been. Can you say that? It has always been one of the most important parts of my year. And so it's not just a day, it's a season. October comes around, and I growing up in an area that was in New England, where the chill would be in the air, the leaves would turn, it would become sweater weather, you'd have hot apple cider, and the Halloween decorations would go up. I've always been a monster kid through and through, so Halloween to me, above any other holiday, always celebrated the spooky, the macabre, the dark elements of culture that I connected with. And when I say culture, it's much more entertainment, but traditions and witches and skeletons and jack-o'-lanterns and cornucopias, all that kind of stuff, blue corn. it's stuff that makes me super happy and nostalgic when I think back about it. So I have very, very many happy memories of trick-or-treating and doing things in autumn, with the autumn harvest and pumpkins. And I was very fortunate. I had a very happy childhood and encouraging parents that let me decorate the house and go out with friends and trick or treat. And, it'll always stick with me as the greatest time of year.
Now, would you have been a scared child with all the monsters and skeletons? Or did you sort of lean into it, the fun aspect that they can't really hurt you? Or what was your relationship with the spookiness?
I don't remember ever being scared. I mean, sure, things scare me. A scary movie will scare me, A jump scare is a jump scare, walking into a dark basement or creepy woods, will scare me. One of my greatest things that I love to watch. I remember watching on Sunday night, the Wonderful World of Disney would be on television. And I remember watching The Legend of Sleepy Hollow, the animated, it was part of a movie, Ichabod and, what is it, Mr. Toad and Ichabod? I get the title wrong, but they divided it up and they took the Legend of Sleepy Hollow segment of that movie and they put it on television. And boy, I lived not 20 minutes from the real Sleepy Hollow. And so I really connected with that. And so Ichabod Crane on his horse in the woods, you know, scared of the headless horseman and, you know, looking at the moon and seeing the clouds like a hand start to obscure it, that scared the crap out of me. And the laugh, you know, the evil laugh of the headless horseman. I have memories of being absolutely scared, but not horrified or terrified or frightened. But that has made always been one of my all-time favorite movies or experiences watching, you know, that because of the spooky element of all of it. You know, I'm obsessed with the Headless Horseman now. Good times, you know, I was never afraid of that kind of stuff. Were you, when you were growing up, did the spooky element of Halloween connect with you in a positive or negative way?
I think obviously positive, because we're here now talking about it and want to talk about it.
Yeah, you're
repressing, not repressing any Halloween memories. But no, it was always a good time. One of my earliest memories, actually, because we had moved house when I was about 3 years old, we'll say. Mm-hmm. Some people might argue I don't have memories from that time, but I certainly do. So it's obviously the first house we lived in, and then the new house. You can differentiate just by the years quite easily. And I think it was, you know, the Halloween before we left, I suppose, because I wouldn't imagine I was running around at 1 year old with memories. But it was just a table filled with plastic masks and spooky, you know, lamps and all sorts of gear and costumes. And it felt to me as if it was a full, like, talk about a bazaar. It actually looked like a full spread of a street market, just filled with masks and treats and everything Halloween. And I was just so absorbed into that and not really seeing anything scary before that. And for any Irish listeners, there used to be on the cartons of milk at Halloween time, there was just a silhouette of a witch on a broom. So what used to happen was my parents were so sick of getting up in the middle of the night to give me bottles of milk that they'd leave the milk carton out on the windowsill. So I'll always remember just like in the moonlight, seeing the silhouette of the witch on the carton. So I must have only been like 2.5 or 3 or something. And it was just always something I associated with Halloween in that regard. So that's where it all started for me. It was like quite early.
Yeah, you laugh, but these are wonderful, happy memories, because the most mundane things arguably make the biggest impact sometimes. I remember 100%. In my neighborhood when I was the littlest of little, we would go. I remember probably it might have been the first time I ever went trick or treating. I don't quite know. But there was this one house that had the talking pumpkin. And I'm sure it was just some guy who had carved out a pumpkin and put a speaker in it. And he had a microphone sitting in the window right behind it out of view. But as a kid, I was convinced that that was a talking pumpkin talking to me, because we had a conversation. And after that, I was like, we got to go to the house of the talking pumpkin. We have to go back. We have to go back to the talking pumpkin. And that made an incredible impact on me. And it's like some guy was just having fun. But think about that. I to this day, I talk about it. And it's a magical moment of Halloween for me. Someone made that effort, and it resonated for my entire lifetime. And I guarantee you, he never would realize that would be the case.
Absolutely, yeah. Because we had a neighbor that used to pull out all the stops. So they had a very like large front garden. So it was actually up a hill, so you had to climb up a hill firstly. So it was all like spooky because it was up at quite a tight laneway. So the where I lived was actually up on a hill, so everything was a little bit tight. Even the road and stuff was narrow.
Mm-hmm.
And you walk up anyway, and you go through the gate, and you have to climb up steps again to get into the garden. And they had the whole place covered in cobwebs. They had the tombstones going, and then you get up, and the whole family is like dressed up, and you know they have like the bowl of peeled grapes and stuff. And, like,
eyeballs.
Stick your hand into the eyeballs, and you're like, ah, and all this kind of, and they really, really put in a good effort with that. I always remember.
That's fun.
But then as the neighborhood kind of grew up, you know, they didn't do it as frequently. Even now, my mother, who's still in the same house, she said the last few years, like, there might only be one pair of kids coming up, because it's just the neighborhood's all grown up now.
Oh, not many
new families there, which is kind of sad. So she gets to eat all the candies herself.
We have in my neighborhood, we have a couple showbiz folks, and someone has a house that when we moved into this neighborhood, unfortunately, we caught the tail end of it, and so I don't think they live there anymore. But every year they had, and this is what the legend was, because people would talk about it, is each year they would have a show at their house, and it was a different theme. And the one year that I did get to go was they had a Jurassic Park theme. And so they created a Jurassic Park gate in front of their house with flames. True. They had actors dressed as the characters, and they would take in groups of like 10 at a time. And they would have this little show like, look, over here, we're going to talk about the DNA. Wait, Jurassic Park's offline. Get out of here quick. And then they'd have massive speakers just out of frame, blasting with the sound of dinosaurs. And they'd run you to the side of the yard where they had a giant T-Rex footprint dug into the dirt. And they had this little sort of back outhouse. And they'd say, I think you're safe here. Just stay here for a moment. And they had a full-on T-Rex head on some sort of a mechanical spring. And it would pop out of this little outhouse and scare the absolute crap out of you. And it was the greatest show. I mean, God, it's epic. Epic.
That's a little bit more elaborate than peel grapes.
Exactly. But no less effective, arguably, than your own imagination of putting your hand in the box that you don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah, no, because it's funny then, because that was obviously like the initial stages. So I go around with like my mom and stuff because we were too young. And I'm just, a memory's popping into my head now of, I think one of the Tim Burton Batmans came out.
Mm-hmm.
So all the effort was put into getting like a really good like Batman mask. Like it was quite a good rendition of that Batman mask at the
right
time. But the actual Batman costume was just a black sheet with a hole.
That works
for my head. So just like, it was just too funny. Like the effort was put in for the head, but not the rest of it.
I can either match that or one up it in my own mind, in that I was a big, huge fan of Felix the Cat, and I watched it all the time when I was a kid, and that's what I wanted to be for Halloween when I was really young. And so my mom made a costume for me, and essentially she painted whiskers on my face, had taken a hanger and bent it to make cat ears. And she made this sort of cloak kind of thing out of this sort of black and white striped material that she found. So I walked around convinced that I looked exactly like Felix the Cat, but I looked more like an escaped convict with cat ears. And I remember going from house to house, and they'd say, "And who are you?" And like by the third house, I'm like, "Well, who do you think I am? I'm Felix the Cat. Why is everyone asking me?"
I know. And then I think when Scream started coming out then, and was a bit older, I used to go to my friend Keith's house, and we used to go around in like twin Scream masks, very imaginative. And we had the voice changer pack to give you like a spooky voice.
Right, yeah.
The speaker was actually in our pocket. So if we were running around panting, all you could hear was just muffled, like, rah, 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 like coming from our pockets. And people are like, what's that? And it's like, oh, that's a voice changer.
These are happy. These are happy memories. They're, you know, the goofier it is, the more endearing it is in your memory.
Yeah, so definitely the last time I went trick-or-treating, we went up to my cousins who are a bit in the rural side of town. Well, not town, but far away. It's one of these towns where, like, they're very close to a, what's it called, like a pharmaceutical plant. Mm-hmm. So it's just like a kind of a satellite town. And so we were going around the suburbs there, and I remember wrapping myself in actual medical bandages as opposed to to be a mummy. And I was trying to get in on the action. So I must have been maybe 14, like too old to be doing the trick-or-treating, but I was the chaperone for the young cousins for the night.
And happy, you were happy to do it, right? It's one more.
Yeah,
you
still, it was good.
It was an excuse to get to dress up and go out even when you were too old, because you didn't want to. You know, there's something about childhood and growing up where you can't wait to be older so you can have your independence. But on the flip side, you want to have it both ways, because when you keep on telling your parents that you want to be older and independent, they let you do things, and then they don't let you do kid things because they say, oh, you're too old. And it's something dies inside. You're like, oh, I'm too old for that now? Oh, man. So
I know, because that's actually then when I got to college, they actually, probably my favorite night of the year for the 4 years that it was on was just a giant theater nightclub place used to put on. It's called Freak Scene Halloween Ball. So it was just, imagine a giant nightclub just filled with everyone in fancy dress for Halloween. It was amazing. Best night 100% of the year. I used to look forward to it every year. So the costumes started getting like more and more elaborate. Like one year we went as like a band of droogs.
Oh, nice.
From Clockwork Orange.
Yep.
Another year I used an old suit and I spray painted it all green and I went as like the Riddler. All these kind of things. It was really cool. And it was the next evolution of, I felt like, the trick-or-treating, where you could actually dress up and become someone else for the night. It's always really fun.
I kind of feel, you know, there are always the duds in the bunch that say that you're behaving like a child. But I think culturally, Halloween and the welcoming appreciation of what you get to do on Halloween, at least here stateside, it's really become as important as, say, Christmas, you know, in the holiday season, in terms of decorations and all that stuff like that. It's much more accepted now than it was, you know, more than 10 years ago, perhaps, with adults going to costume parties and that kind of stuff like that, where everyone does it. I mean, it's not like people have hidden in the shadows doing it. But I kind of feel like it's much more part of sort of the cultural pulse now than it was maybe a decade or more before.
Yeah, well, I can safely say down in Australia, there's not much interest in Halloween, because I guess we're actually, you know, middle of spring now, coming into summer. It's just not the same. Like, you need it to be autumnal, because a little bit of trivia for those who don't know, like, Halloween is an ancient Irish like feast day. It's Iha Samhain. It's basically the night of Samhain, and Samhain is Irish for November. And it's the night before, and it's the last day where night overtakes darkness. So it's like the thinning of the veil then is like the legend that all the ghouls and ghosts can come through the void on that day. That's kind of where I came from. It's like a harvest festival. Because there isn't going to be any more daylight after that day.
Right.
So, and then the Americans took it to the extreme, as Americans do, and they made it great. I always used to love like the Halloween movies, just all those. It seems like the same suburb in every single movie, but that just might be it the way it is. I don't know.
Well, I have to interject real quick. I lived in the UK when I was in college. I was there first, you know, I was there for my junior year abroad. And I remember around Halloween, I was all excited, and I was only slowly cluing in that the Brits were just not interested. There were some pockets who were kind of celebrating it, but they're like, I'd walk around and I'd say, mask, you know, do you have any masks? Are you selling any masks? And they're like, oh, you mean for Guy Fawkes Day? And I'm just like, well, not really for Halloween, actually. But, you know, I got a bit of an education. But I think since then, since I was there, it's also been much more embraced by the UK as a whole.
Yeah, it's fab. Honestly, it's our favorite time of year. We actually put up stickers on our window, like little pumpkins and cobwebs and silly little things like that.
You guys have come a long way from when I was there.
Yeah, well, Ireland is a lot better at the Halloween because it's like our festival.
Yeah. It's like it's ours, so we'll stick to much more.
Any opportunity I have, I will tell people it's an Irish festival. Anyone who will listen. So do you have any more things that popped out for you of like growing up or any other memories that you're repressing?
Oh, I have absolutely. They're definitely not repressed. They're all very fresh memories and all very, very happy memories. I mean, there's just a large amount of them. But I remember, you know, talking about like getting a little bit too old. There was this sort of evolutionary tween age where you were too cool to go trick or treating, but you still wanted to be a kid and go. So you would dress as a bum. Everyone's like, you're going to dress as a bum. And, you know, we'd blacken your face with a burnt cork and, you know, we'd have shaving cream fights and egg fights and stuff like that, which is obviously sounds very sophomoric, but that was kind of my neighborhood, and it was an excuse to go trick-or-treating and going out when you pretty much were too old to do it because it was still a kiddie thing. So I have happy memories of just doing that.
Those are all your memories now of trick-or-treating and Halloween, but now as a father yourself, how's your son with Halloween? Does he care much for it? Or
well, he's grown up from a dad who is just he's given him a steady year-round supply about how Halloween is the greatest thing on earth, and so he's into it, and so he loves it quite a bit. We go out, we've been going trick-or-treating in the neighborhood, which is a great neighborhood. I mean, people really decorate their houses and go crazy ever since he was a baby. I mean, I would just carry him around and they'd say, oh, how cute. And he was just a little drooling baby. He had no idea what was going on, but it was an excuse for me to trick or treat with him. But unfortunately, we actually live on a very steep hill where it's a dark walk up the hill. And the most depressing element that I had to adjust to is the fact that no one comes to trick or treat at our house. So we go down the hill and then do a huge amount of trick-or-treating, but we still decorate our house. We still put out, you know, a fake graveyard in the front yard, and these days you can get like an inflatable thing, and we've sort of fallen prey to that and do inflatable creatures in front. And it's a month-long celebration. And actually, I've evolved to my wife is really big on the Christmas holiday. And when I first met her, she had this whole set of these miniature houses and cottages and stuff like that, that, you know, you plug in and they light up. And we would put that on our mantle over the fireplace. We have this nice shelf over the fireplace where you could put a whole town there. And so around Halloween, I saw some of these things that you could buy. And I'm like, I'd like one of those. So I bought a haunted house. And then of course, it's a very, very slippery slope. And so now on Halloween, or, you know, at the end of September, first day of October, the Halloween town and the graveyards go up on our mantle place. And that stays up. I will keep that up through November until I'm told to take it down. But I get to do that as well. But there's a lot of joy and just, you know, it's, I don't know. Like I can't articulate how I feel, but it just gives me tremendous joy and happiness. And it's satisfaction of keeping one foot firmly in the past of a very happy childhood growing up with Halloween memories and Very, very happy that A, I can pass it along to my son, and B, that he's receptive to it. And so we all win because he loves the Christmas stuff too. And so we kind of, you know, it's sort of, and his birthday's in November. So it's just like, you know, pretty much from end of September through the beginning of January, it's much more festive around our house than the rest of the year.
Nice. That's a good chunk. And is actually trick-or-treating, is it canceled now this year with the coronavirus?
We're not going to go, but we'll watch spooky movies and we're still decorating the house. And my son knows that it's just not going to happen. And I can't even imagine what the long-term psychological effects of all the kids is going to be, you know, homeschooling and remote learning and all that, and just being away from their friends and not running around and organized, you know, activities and sports, all that stuff like that. But
yeah,
but he is an absolute champ. He's a smart kid. You know, sure, I'm his dad, I could say that, but he's a smart kid in that he's perceptive enough to know that it's a shit storm out there and we're safe at home. And we're just, you know, it will end at a certain point and he just has to be patient. And as long as he's got Wi-Fi, he's good to go. He'll wait out the storm.
Yeah. Imagine if this happened 30 years ago.
Well, we'd be reading books and listening to the Little Orphan Annie on the radio and The Shadow and The Lone Ranger and, you know, watching TV, whatever's on TV, we just watch it or, you know, pre-cable days, pre-VHS days, pre-all that stuff like that. I still think we'd all make do. I think lastly I'll say about that element is that it is very difficult for everyone. We all know that. But some, it's harder for others. And I consider myself extremely fortunate that we at least live in a neighborhood where we could take walks outside and get some exercise and be outside and not be literally cooped up in the house. You know, once everyone gets their act together, and we'll just be patient and wait out the storm.
Of course, yeah. No, it's good that we can touch in remotely. We've yet to meet each other in person, despite all these virtual visits.
Yeah, I'm not convinced that you have a lower half. You need to prove that to me in person one day.
I know, I've never stood up. Maybe I can't. I'd be like that guy out of Wild Wild West who only had a top half.
Yeah, you've got robotic spider legs below, for all I know.
Very spooky. So just to bring us to our next little, to dovetail all the nice chat about kind of growing up around Halloween, if you were to pick one Halloween movie then to put on repeat, what would it be?
It's a tough one. I will give you an answer, but there is not one individual one. I like to save John Carpenter's Halloween for Halloween, or at least the day before, because that music really evokes the whole season, and it's one of my all-time favorite movies. So it would probably be John Carpenter's Halloween on Halloween. But I really do love the spooky stuff. And to me, that is the connection to the Universal horror films and even the Hammer horror films as well. The staple for the season, at least for my family, to the point where we quote it all the time at home, is Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. You know, because it's funny, it's scary, it's got all the classic monsters. It's such a gem. And to me, it's a bit cliche, but I always want to mention it because I think there's lots of people out there who don't realize or don't think that, oh, you know, Abbott and Costello comedies, that can't be good or funny. Or they think, oh, Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, okay. But they don't realize that Dracula and the Wolfman, and, you know, it's like a greatest hits package of Universal horror films with really spot on comedy, whether it's physical comedy or the wordplay. So definitely seek that out. And I would say those two are my picks. How about you?
Okay, well, just out of pure necessity and the, I wouldn't even call it nostalgia. Maybe it is trauma. I don't know about this movie. But just to paint the scene of Ireland's TV scape in the 1990s, there was only three channels. We were not fortunate enough in my household to have the quote unquote black box, or I don't know, some people would call it a dodgy box that had 14 channels that you get from the UK. I don't know, is it like tapping into satellite or something? I don't know what was happening. But we only had the three channels. And if you only had the three channels, it was known as you had the poverty channels. We had the poverty channels for, I'd say, up until the last maybe 10 years. So that's painting the scene. So there was RTE1, which is more like news documentaries. It was a bit for like more informative. And RTE's Radio Telefiche Éireann, which is actually the national broadcaster. So it's state sponsored. And then the second one was RTE2. So it was just the next channel that actually had like more movies and shows and sports, we'll say. It was a little bit more like for the young people. And then there was TG Cahir, which is actually the Irish language channel. So no one really wanted to watch TG Cahir, but it also actually late at night had all the really good American shows because they had such a high budget because it was in Irish. So they'd like subtitle it in Irish, but they'd have just, it was in English, obviously, but they had the good shows. So every week then, they had like the big, big movie. So every Halloween for as long as I could remember, like 7, 8, 9, 10 years in a row, they used to play Hocus Pocus. So I would have to pick Hocus Pocus, I think. the one that always scared me at the start, for the first few years, and it's the only character name I remember, but it was Billy the Zombie.
Played by Doug Jones, right?
Oh, was it Doug Jones?
Doug Jones.
Must have been one of his early ones.
With his mouth sewed shut, and he kind of has a Johnny Depp kind of look.
Yeah, that freaked me out when he was like muffling, and they had to cut open his mouth. And then as the years progressed, I realized that Billy was a good guy, you know. But it was always the initial scene where he got resurrected and had his mouth shut. It was very freaky. So I think I'd have to pick Hocus Pocus, but much like yourself, the second pick, I do really enjoy trying on John Carpenter's Halloween at Halloween, because just that whole suburban Halloween trick-or-treating thing that we were just mentioning, it does really evoke the spirit of Halloween. I think it's a fantastic movie in that regard, and it does inject a bit of terror into something that should be kind of so innocent, but it brings it back to the sort of like gnarliness of the true spirit of Halloween, if that makes sense. It's a good movie.
You know, Hocus Pocus was I think it was either top box office last weekend or the number two, but it was because the whole dynamic has shifted with, you know, drive-in movies versus going to the theater, and a lot of new movies are being pushed, and a lot of you know, thematic programming is happening now, and Hocus Pocus went out there and it won the weekend, which is pretty cool.
It's crazy.
But that movie, has gained tremendous momentum since it was released, because it didn't burn up the charts when it first came out. But it's much like Nightmare Before Christmas, which also didn't burn up, you know, the box office when it first came out. It has proven staying power, and a lot of people grew up with it, whether they were watching it on TV or whoever they saw it. It's an annual tradition, and so cannot be denied that there's a huge audience for those movies.
Yeah, no, there is. And speaking of other movies that are in the works or ready to be talked about, at least today we want to talk about a little bit, touch on In Search of Darkness 2, and I just keep making the joke, Search Harder.
Search Harder, that's right. Killer segue, harder. By the way. Killer segue.
I know. So In Search of Darkness 2, you are the commander-in-chief of that project.
Yeah, that's right.
Looking after that. So tell us a little bit about that one. I must say, firstly, and I've said it to you many times, but the first In Search of Darkness, for those listening, go seek it out. It's if you're anyway tangentially a horror fan, I think you'll get a lot out of it. It's 4 hours long, so make sure to put in the catheter before you start.
That's right. Make and, sure all food and drink is within reach.
Yeah. You know, it is really good.
You're the first person to suggest a catheter. I think it's a wise idea.
So, yes, is the second one as long? Will I need to keep it on?
Yeah, you'll need two catheters. it's 4.5 hours. Again, it's the same exact length, give or take a minute or two. It's the same length. It's I delivered, like the first one, I delivered a 5-hour cut, and then I had to trim it back. So there's babies I had to kill. There was so much material, and it's all brand new stuff. In Search of Darkness Part 1, for the uninitiated, I think I mentioned earlier, you know, it goes between 1980 and 1989 and covers a variety of movies. But this time we're going broader and with a world view and movies from around the world. Lots of, you know, there's a whole chapter on Italian horror, and you know, Fulci and Argento and Bava and the like. And, you know, I talked to Shinya Tsukamoto, the director of Tetsuo, the Iron Man, and his entry. And, you know, there's just so much more to tackle, so much conversation to be had. We have 15 brand new faces. Robert Englund, Freddie himself, is in the movie. Tom Savini, who, you know, we wanted all these guys the first time around, but we weren't able to pin them down. And this time we did. So, you know, effects legend Rob, Tom Savini's in it. Steve Johnson is in it as well. And Matt Winston, the son of Stan Winston, talking about his legendary father. Linnea Quigley, Nancy Allen, Clancy Brown, Robert Ressler, Getty Watanabe, who were in Vamp together. Robert Ressler was in Nightmare on Elm Street 2 with Robert Englund, talking solely about that movie. Is pretty interesting, because if you know anything about Nightmare on Elm Street 2, there's a whole connotation there that it's connected to now that a lot of people didn't realize when it first came out. It's definitely interesting. And a variety of folks returning as well with brand new interviews. Like, there's brand new interviews with Bill Moseley and Cassandra Peterson, who plays Elvira. Phil Noble Jr. of Fangoria is back. So much material. Chris Jericho, Corey Taylor, those guys are in it. I mean, check out the cast. If you go to 80shorrordoc.com, you'll realize how many cool people are in this movie, whether they were from the era or fans of the era and know what they're talking about. We do a deep dive into all new movies and all new larger context chapters about horror in the 80s and horror movie movement and the impact and the nostalgia. Joe Dante's back. John Carpenter's back for more. Barbara Crampton and the late, great Stuart Gordon. There's some really great material from the first one that we never used, where he's talking about some of his passion project that he never quite got to make. There's so much fun stuff here, and it's an ongoing story. And with In Search of Darkness Part 1, you may or may not thought of, we just scratched the surface. There's just so much richness in that era and that practical effects era. And we explore that much more. And I think it's real fun. It's got a good sense of humor. It moves at quite a fast clip, just like the last one did. And, you know, you have between now and Halloween to get your hands on it. Then it's going to be very scarce.
Are you trying to do a Nintendo on it now with your Super Mario All-Stars? Why is it going to be scarce?
So the people who get to see it and get their name in the credit, they have bragging rights for quite some time.
Excellent. So initially, so is it just being released now to get your name in the credits, and then will it be available after the fact?
That's the plan. There's no plan for what's next. We're focusing, because we're a small company, we focus on one thing at a time, and that's to get this to everyone now, get their name in the credits. They get a package with all sorts of cool stuff, posters and enamel pin and slipcover and digital download of the movie. And their Blu-ray or the DVD of the movie. Plus, if you missed the first one, you get a free digital copy, digital copy. It's easy for me to say, free digital copy of that one. And if you want a physical copy, you can order that as well for like $15. It's super cheap. And there's also a whole online Discord community that we're doing where we're giving you a 12-month pass to connect with other horror fans, where we're doing regular watch parties and Q&As with a lot of the horror talent from that era. And we've been doing that for quite some time over the summer, which is perfect for all those folks who are looking to connect and escape online since they can't quite do it in the real life, in the real world. So, yeah, the first watch party we had was Reanimator, and we had Jeffrey Combs there to talk and interact with the fans. And it's been very cool to create this sort of big nostalgic comfort blanket for everybody that goes beyond this documentary, where if you put the two documentaries together, you already have 9 hours of material.
Now, guys, if you are just listening to David talking about that, I can vouch for all the projects, because David is like a drug dealer. He gave me the first hit of In Search of Darkness on the arm, as they say, and I was blown away. I was like, wow, this is actually very good, because you had been talking about it for so long before it came out, and then it came out and I was like, holy shit, it's actually good.
Right, it could have gone a radically different way, I suppose.
And guys, then, because you talk about the Discord, I have been on the Discord, but how did I get in the Discord if I didn't back something? I backed In Search of Tomorrow because I am looking forward into the future tomorrow for In Search of Tomorrow. I put my money where my mouth is, and I paid this time. So the Discords are fab. They're really good interactions there. The watch parties are great. So there's like one movie like picked every week, I think, actually. And there's always a guest involved who actually might have been involved in the movie. So it's not just chatting. There's a lot more going on than meets the eye. It's a really slick operation you have there.
Well, thanks. Yeah, I mean, I appreciate you backing it as well. And you're very right. You know, we knew each other before I delivered this movie, so I could have delivered a turkey. Arguably, I did. Who knows? Depends on who you are and what you like and what you expect. But people have really responded positively to this. In Search of Darkness 1 is on Shudder currently, and a whole new audience has been discovering it. And, you know, if anything, it's good for curation of all these great titles that you might not have heard of, or if you weren't ever sure what it was about. You know, it's like if Joe Dante is talking about how great Cure Clowns are, it might be back on your radar where it wasn't on it there in the first place. So, you know, it's an entertaining, nostalgic ride, and it's a love letter to the decade. And now it's part one and part two.
Superb. And is there anything next in the pipeline? Is any other projects that you can talk about, or have you even thought about anything?
Well, we've been talking about all sorts of things, because we're building a core group of followers who seems to really love what we're doing and want more of it. And so, you know, next on my plate is delivering In Search of Tomorrow next fall. But the after that, we're talking about In Search of Darkness 90s. We're talking about In Search of, we don't even know what it's going to be called, but like a fantasy, 80s fantasy movies, you know, Sword and Sorcery and Conan and Krull and everything in between.
That could be called In Search of Pants.
In Search of Pants, In Search of Men in Tights, In Search of Swords and Sandals. But yeah. It's an ongoing conversation. There's just so much fertile ground with these movies that we love. And it's really great to sit down with all these people who are part of it. And, you know, who knows? Maybe there'll be more In Search of Darkness 80s, or In Search of Darkness Part 3, because there's already material made that's sitting on the cutting room floor because we couldn't fit it in for this second round. So, you know, if the response is positive enough for In Search of Darkness Part 2, we can keep on going. So lots of big plans and hopes and dreams and aspirations. But fundamentally, it's really a small group that's doing this, and it's a real labor of love. And, you know, it's really by the fans for the fans. And we're really passionate about this stuff. And We want the product to be the best thing it can be. That, and we're doing it all ourselves. We're not just sort of making these movies and giving it to a distributor and forgetting about it. We're trying to build a collective community around these ideas and discussions and passions. And it's like a big club that's very welcoming and not cynical and not clicky, and real proud of that.
No, it's great. And I suppose, it seems to be a common question I'm asking in the last few episodes, but what have been the challenges, if any, that you've had given the pandemic? Has it halted production schedules, or is there interviews that you just couldn't do, or how did you manage that the last couple of months?
Yeah, well, it's a very good question, because it has been, you know, we're like everyone else. Our production was shut down for In Search of Tomorrow and In Search of Darkness Part 2. And we had about 3 months where we really couldn't go out and do anything. And once we did start going out, it was a bit sort of tepid at first. A lot of the people who said, yeah, sure, I'm happy to be part of this, they, you know, and I do not fault them. They said, sorry, I can't go out. I can't come out and interview them, or not going to, you know.
Because they're all a bit older as well. They're the risk categories.
It's very much so. And it's very much the case. And so I absolutely respect that and understand that completely. So, you know, while we would have liked, and we had lined up and would have liked a lot more brand new faces to continue this story, I'm very happy that not only did we get 15 new faces, but we got a total of 23 new interviews with people. So we can continue this conversation and do this deeper dive and broader worldview. So I'm very happy that we were able to accomplish that. So, yeah, I mean, we did kind of have one hand tied behind our back in terms of production, but the gift of this entire project is that we had such a wealth of material from the first round, because I sat down with everyone for 1 hour, 2 hours or more. And so there was all this amazing material that literally just could not physically make the first cut. It's not like all the best bits went in and everything else went on the cutting room floor. There was lots of difficult decisions about what we would include and not include, because so much of it was so good. So I got to use a lot of that to integrate and keep the conversation going with the new material. And it all flows and integrates really well together in this sort of mega jigsaw puzzle that we call In Search of Darkness.
Super. Well, I'm going to look forward to that one when I eventually have 5 free hours almost to sit down. No, it's very easy to cut into chunks, because if I recall, you just split it into different years in the last one.
Yeah, it's a big cross section. So you can watch it by year, you can watch it by chapter, you can watch it by film. Ultimately, the navigation is real easy to find all these things. And so no one is expected to sit for a 4.5 hour sit. That's a tall order. And so it was always designed where you can kind of pick up where you left off and just start with a new year or a new chapter, or skip around to your favorites. It's pretty easy to navigate.
Yeah, definitely. Well, as I said, yes, I do very much look forward to that. And you always do deliver now. Well, not always, but you have a good track record so far. So hopefully this will be as enjoyable as the first one. And I am, as I said, very much looking forward to In Search of Tomorrow for the sci-fi, because I think I told you before, the triforce of my movie interests are horror, sci-fi, and action. And you actually, the company, Creator VC, do I have that right?
Yep.
Yeah, Creator VC has done
all three.
The golden triangle for me. So that's absolutely great. So, David, if people do want to pick this up before the 31st, the All Hallows Eve, Iha Samhain, where can people find it online, and where can they find you, more importantly, as well?
Well, people could go to 80shorrordoc.com. All the socials, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, is 80shorrordoc. And that's the place to go. And the deadline is Halloween at midnight, wherever you are. That's the deadline, midnight. So make sure you get it beforehand, because so many people are like, oh, well, isn't it going to be streaming at this place, or I could buy it on iTunes? And there's no plans for any of that stuff. So now's the time to get it. And a lot of times people also talk about how they wish they had taken advantage of getting their name in the credits and at least just getting a copy of the Blu-ray or the DVD. It's going to be hard to find. And then it ends up on eBay for three times and four times what people paid for it. So, you know, wait at your peril. But that being said, I encourage everyone, if you liked In Search of Darkness 1, I think you will like In Search of Darkness 2 just as much, because it is a continuation of the format. So I think people will really connect to it. So go to 80shorrordoc.com. And for me, my socials, you can go find me on Twitter at Tiki Ambassador. And I have my own site, which is a sort of a genre pop culture site called itcamefromblog.com. And you can find me on those socials as well, on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at itcamefromblog. So that's it for my plugs. But it's always a pleasure to chat with you, Richard, and I appreciate you having me back.
No, always a pleasure to speak to you, David. I'm sure we'll be chatting again sometime in the future, no doubt.
Indeed.
But that has been another episode of the Bizarre Cast. And if you really want to kick it back old school, I even forgot to mention these old parlor games of bobbing for apples. You can push a few coins into those. Whoever gets them, you can have an apple on a string. What else did we have? Stupid little things like that.
Pin the tail on the witch. I don't know.
Yeah. silly little games like that.
We used to play Hang the Witch, poke at the leprosy. No, kidding. I don't know. It sounds terrible.
It's all bobbing for apples. So always a good time.
Morbid humor, anyway.
So everyone, to finally wrap around, thank you all for listening. Stay scary, stay safe, and have a big happy Halloween as best you can. I hope you enjoyed yourselves. Check us out at the Bizarrecast. Any comments, questions, anything like that, same Bizarrecast, thebizarrecast@gmail.com. And join the Discord, and we'll be happy to say hello. So until next time, goodbye.
Ow.
End of line.